Welcome to CMU Booked, Carnegie Mellon's official book podcast.
This week, we're going to be talking to Stephen Makin. Steve is a junior in the creative writing department with an additional major in film. He co-runs the literary magazine on campus, The Oakland Review, and writes fairly often for the school paper. He currently interns for the CMU Press. So Steve's pick was A Canticle for Leibowitz, written by Walter M. Miller Jr., considered one of the sci-fi masterpieces of the 20th century.
And this novel was written in 1959, and it is quite a beast of a book. It's a fix-up of three short stories, Fiat Homo, Fiat Lux, and Fiat Voluntas Tua. It follows an alternate American society following a nuclear holocaust, which in the novel is referred to as the Flame Deluge. And it follows the society, which centers around this religious figure that is eventually canonized called Saint Leibowitz. His name is Isaac Leibowitz, and it's about the technological and spiritual journey of these societies over different centuries. We have big time jumps.
So you can tell it covers a lot of ground, and we're super excited to talk about it. Enjoy, team.
Steve, it's great to have you on the pod. I know you started this novel before both Sam and I, and so I was, you know, wondering as a little icebreaker, how did it even get into your hands in the first place? What grabbed your attention and sort of motivated you to keep reading and then recommend it?
Truthfully, it was a Christmas gift from a couple of years ago that I got from my Uncle Stephen. And whenever he gives me books to read for presents, my parents always rush to tell me not to read them. They scream that he's attempting actively to make me an atheist, which probably isn't true. But but anyway, I've been sitting on this book for a while, and I figured that this was, if nothing else, a great excuse to get it read.
This is like a great excuse for me to read it, because it's definitely not something that I would have picked up unless my Uncle Steve were to have given it to me.
Really? This isn't right up your alley? Sam, I'm astounded.
I had never heard of this book before, so after reading the description of it that you had kind of sent over and as like a feeler, I was like, I'm super down, because you know I love dystopia, and I really liked Dune, which we did, you know, a few episodes ago, so I was like, yeah, this sounds like it'll be fun.
Well, that was actually his pitch to me when he gave it to me, was he said, it's like Dune, which he had given me the previous year.
That,
or his brother, I don't remember.
I mean, I wrote down this is like Dune without the context.
Dune for me is far more accessible than this book. I feel like it's raising a lot of questions in the same vein of the decade in which it was produced. But I feel like this is a much harder book to grasp, both in dialogue and contextually, historically, just given how many cultural and religious references there are. So I guess if someone was a big Dune lover, I don't know if I would jump to this. It does have sort of this intense world building, different sorts of Bibles and stuff. And so I was sort of wondering, is there anything that you sort of connected it to yourself aside from Dune or other books that you've read?
It read more than anything else like a campus novel, like a university novel, at least for the first two stories, if for no other reason than it has all the similar tropes. I mean, our first main character that we see, Brother Francis, is the quintessential campus novel. They literally call him a simpleton. He comes from simpletons from Utah. And it reminded me of the main character of Stoner, who comes from this farming background and finds himself at a university, and he finds his home in the English department, lives there forever till he dies in some miserable way. It's tropey in campus novel sort of vein. I think a lot of it is about higher education. Granted, I've read some of Dune, but I think they, as in the writers, allot their points in similar areas versus ignore other areas. I think both a book like Leibowitz and a book like Dune, they pay a lot of attention to stuff like mastering biblical diction, for instance, to have effective allegory versus, I mean, look at some of the dialogue in this book. You have all caps and multiple punctuation marks and various grammatical rule breakage, because that's not what it cares about. It's not trying its darndest to be objectively literary.
I also feel like in the vein of what you're talking about, of this complex language reflecting the thematic points, perhaps. I mean, maybe that's what I'm reading into it. I feel like the fact that it's so hard to grasp at times, especially with terminology, is sort of what you're talking about with like knowledge and higher education and knowledge being both a death in certain ways, but also as life, which I think is interesting, especially in the idea of sort of religion and science supporting one another to persist.
Religion and science are super intertwined depending on which part of the book you're talking about. Do you see one as a backdrop for the other? Or is it like, is science a backdrop for religion in this or the other way around? Or is it totally like they're just intermixed completely?
I think at the very least you see the progression from 1 to 2 to 3, where in the first story it's religion sort of grasping at the coattails of science and not knowing what to do with any of it. And then in the third, it's science has sort of left it behind and now religion is trying to be the moral police and it's not really working. But in the second, you see the closest you can probably come to a good marriage of the two.
Totally. And
it comes about in this bizarre early civilization way.
I'm curious as to how doubt plays into those different variations in the narrative. In the first one, we get a lot of scientific doubt and the fact that it's so concealed. And I was wondering if that element of concealment with respect to both religion and with science, how did that affect your perception of specifically Francis and in contrast to Father Abbott, who are both of the main players in the first story? I was just sort of interested in that concealment aspect.
I don't know. Regarding Francis, he's a strange character. You can almost say that religion here is something to be taken for granted. You might even say it's not an uber key part of his role because it could have been anything else. It's just his backbone that he's submerged in. He could have been submerged in, you know, Buddhism and it wouldn't have changed the story. I don't think very much at all. Or he could have been in a real-life university. He could have been in, like, soccer academy, soccer every day.
Right, because at the end of the day, it's about constructing narrative through these different elements. And I think that the fact that it's this Christianity-focused religion, if we could call it anything.
I think it's specifically Catholicism.
Oh, it's specifically Catholicism, because there are so many also elements of, like, Hebrew language and old Hebrew language and Judaism, which plays into, right, like the overall Christianity. So like I understand that, but like the idea of canonization, this construction of narrative, which is also history, it reminded me very much of like Orwell, Tolkien, and the idea of like these big travesties affecting things. And so I guess like in that construction of narrative, like what did you make of it? Especially because You're a creative writer.
You can definitely see it. Religion specifically becomes something that you cannot take for granted by the time you get to the third story because all of a sudden you introduce choice.
Mm.
It starts when you first see all the different tribes and you see some that are no longer subscribing to the faith. You see some that have never subscribed to the faith. And then all of a sudden in the third story, the faith is totally separate from anyone in charge, right? They're very much their own thing and they sort of get stomped on. I would say that it's the choice that forms the bulk of the meaning of the novel going forward.
I think that the idea of choice is really interesting for these specific characters, especially talking about Francis, who in the beginning, I mean, like he's kind of, you call him a simpleton. I mean, that's what the author calls him. Mm-hmm. But he's such a follower, which I think makes it really interesting to have him kind of kick off the narrative. Do you see like this moral compass in Francis, or is he just, like Hannah says, you know, just a follower? And that goes for a lot of the other characters too.
He does start out as this agency-less unit who almost could have been anyone else. And I think that's very much part of it. And you get to thinking that, you know, right before it ends and right before his untimely demise, that he might be this chosen one figure. But really, it tells the story of a guy who exhausted his life's worth. I mean, he got to the maximum point that a guy like him could have hoped to get to. And, I mean, looking back, it almost would have been silly to give him any more to do.
What's the symbolism there and his death? Why have him die like that
when he goes? Eyes.
Yeah, when he goes back to avenge one of the, right, how many years, 15 years he spends on the reconstruction of supposed St. Leibowitz, like, blueprints. And poor bastard, this robber just totally steals it from him when he's trying to get to New Rome for St. Leibowitz's canonization, and it gets stolen. And they're like, yeah, if you bring back some gold, then, you know, we'll give it back to you. But then when they have him make this return, he goes back and he's shot between the eyes. Where's the symbolism there in what you're talking about?
I think it's super on the nose. If there was ever a way for him to die, it was to die totally on his moral compunction. I mean, he was going to go back and try to do this thing diplomatically. He wasn't going to do it very well because he doesn't really know how. Yeah, he gets fooled, really. He gets fooled.
Do we see any character development from Francis before he's shot between the eyes?
Just enough to get him to New Rome.
He does stop fainting in front of, you know, respected officials. but I'm still really compelled to him as a character. And I think that it's one of the stronger stories out of the three.
I think it was just enough character development to get him to his maximum potential as a man, or as a man of faith, or as a man who was born in the conditions that he was. Because if you recall, we get some of his backstory. And he comes from effectively the middle of nowhere, and he was chased out by savage people who wanted to wasn't he a slave?
He was a
shaman.
Yeah, he was enslaved.
He escapes that and ends up in this situation, which is already better, but you might say that he's a slave now to the faith, but he has some grounds for social mobility, and he gets to the top of that. It's not like in the second story where he might have the choice to go off to a village somewhere, a city, and have success in the secular world. This is, strictly speaking, some of the best he could do as a man of certain morals. If he had been asked, not that this would have made any sense, but if he had been asked at the beginning to trek it to New Rome and do all these things, I don't think he would have made it.
Ooh.
Or even left.
There's no reason for him to be dissatisfied.
Just to go back to like the doubt aspect of this and the fact that he's able to, I think we see a transformation, right, intellectually and mobility-wise, in the fact that, right, people take to him and understand his passions. But it's very interesting how throughout the entire first story, the point of conflict in between him and his superiors is the fact that he has to say, I think. He can't say that he knows anything for sure. That doubt is what limits the people who are in charge of him and the ones who want to construct a narrative for their religion and for St. Leibowitz. But it's almost through his doubt and through his saying, I think, sort of invalidates the surroundings that he's in.
These people are blind followers, and that they want these, like, really able to be molded and just believe anything you tell them. But Francis, as a character, somebody that, like you said, like, is enabled by doubt and wants to believe the things that are, you know, right in front of him. He has firsthand evidence that this stuff happened, so he's not going to believe it when somebody is like, no, you have to, you know, follow this.
And we are in the Dark Ages.
I'm thinking back to those first couple times when he's being interrogated by the abbot and he keeps going, I think, I think, I think. And really, the abbot wants him to say straight out, because it would be the easiest thing and probably the best thing going forward, that he did not see St. Leibowitz there, because doing so, it's almost delusions of grandeur that he doesn't want to have to deal with. He thinks that if that goes ahead, it'll actually cast in some convoluted way a negative light on his abbey. It'll make them all look like fools who are trying desperately to get their beatus, I think is how it's said, canonized.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a thing of convenience. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, at the end of the day, the religion is a system in society, and it's a, you know, it's a production, whatever you want to use for it. So I think it's also funny to see those characters that are like, I don't want to do the paperwork for this.
Religion middle management.
Totally.
It's like when you're watching The Lord of the Rings, and then there's that one orc that comes up to Saruman and starts talking about how they don't have the resources.
I do think it reiterates core religious beliefs, though, in still talking about these technological advancements. Poverty is masked with dignity. It's like suffering gives you this monopoly culturally. And I mean, St. Leibowitz is a martyr. He died in the name of upholding this old technology and wanting people to have access. He was a booklegger, is what they call him, which I did love as a term. Within that poverty masked as dignity, I'm interested in considering how that relates to the time period in which this novel was birthed, which is Red Scare prime time, or even a little after that, where like Cold War's in full swing and people are very concerned about what just happened with Hiroshima, and we have this space race. And I think that it's interesting that suffering gives you power, at least here, or if you hold it dignified, then you are accepted.
I think it's, I mean, it's got to be a little sardonic at the very least. I mean, once you take the third story into account, which gives the exact opposite, right, total foil of these people dying of terrible, terrible radiation poisoning, and the abbot is saying, he's, you know, dying on that hill of don't pursue euthanasia, right, because you lose that constructed moral high ground, even though you're going to die this long, slow, horrible death. It comes down, again, to choice. It's a choice for the reader. Given the time period of the first story where there's nothing but suffering, everyone is suffering, and so you get the sense that the monks have taken up this lifestyle almost because it's a intellectualization and romanticization of the things that they can't escape, right? These are going to be their rituals anyway.
The past and the future will always follow that. It sort of simplifies sort of the violence of both the past and the future, and sort of the truth at its core. With Brother Francis, when we got to the second story, I was sort of confused as to how we had jumped from someone as pious and maybe, you know, more impressionable, far more than our second protagonist, Thaddeo. Guys, Walter M. Miller Jr. did not make the names easy for us. In the third, we have, what is it, Father Zerchi? Okay. I was surprised and curious as to how we went from Brother Francis to Thaddeo. We have an idealist, or someone who's interested in things, who is so limited, versus Thaddeo, who is very calculating, can get around this system, is higher up, but is allowed and fervent in intellectualism and this progress. And so do you think that the choice to move to that protagonist follows the same trajectory of the one that you established for us at the beginning?
Truthfully, I don't think I read Thaddeo as the protagonist of that part.
Oh.
I read Dom Paolo.
Yes.
As the protagonist. And then I looked at Thaddeo as almost this, I don't want to call him a background figure, like odious, because obviously he's not, and you get a lot even just from his perspective, but he's almost a tool, and he doesn't think he's a tool, and he's doing all these things. I mean, they give you that metaphor of, well, he's trying to rebrand himself as a discoverer when all he is a rediscoverer of old technologies. He's never going to discover something new.
Loved that line.
Iconic.
Loved that line.
I think it's very much true, even in a meta sort of way for the reader, that Thaddeo doesn't really. I mean, he thinks he has agency, but really it all comes down to one choice that he has to make at the end. When he leaves the abbey, he has to decide whether he wants to screw them over or save them, because he could do either one. Not even morals, because his morals change. I think he has the most character development over the story.
I also wanted to ask you in that same vein about like the transition from Francis to Thaddeo. As we move throughout the main characters, and whoever you take to be the main character, are we getting more positive? Are we getting that progress that we're kind of like, you know, teetering around sometimes? Or is it all futile? Is it all futile, Steve?
In all ways that matter, it's a positive direction.
Yeah.
But you see them in the third story at the beginning where they're getting angry at all their electronic equipment. They've begun the age-old tale of becoming frustrated with their very small problems.
Where are we? Oh, are we for second or third story right now?
We, like, yeah. The real world?
Yeah.
I guess. Right before the third story.
Oh, you mean 2025 right now?
2025. What's today? November? I'm curious. Your thoughts too, Hannah. Like, where are we at?
Oh, girl. There's no way we're in the Renaissance. Like, there ain't no way we're in the Renaissance. I'm sorry. Somewhere in between Renaissance and modernity, there's just such a drastic jump. So then what does the title mean to you of this short story, of the second story, Fiat Lux? I mean, Let There Be Light, right? At least what I got from it is light, especially in the second story, right? Like, they build a lamp. He discovers electricity. And Don Taddeo is super gagged because he's like, how did he jump to this so quickly? Which I think was also interesting in the sense of technological process. Here, moving far quicker than social progress, at least from the Dark Ages to the Renaissance. I feel like there was a lot more of that. But then what is the light? Is that Lucifer?
When they built the light, they were all freaked out.
Yeah.
It was brighter than they had ever imagined, and it scared them. I think that's meant to be a very easy line between that and technological progress to the point where it becomes dangerous. Again, cyclical nature of humanity. Eventually, you're going to get back to nuclear weapons, and even if you agree for a while not to use them, they will be forever on the table. Light as knowledge?
Yeah.
And sometimes it's too bright.
Yes.
And everyone runs.
That's so apparent in Paolo's whole paradox here, where he's both, like, he has a growing curiosity, but then there's also a sense of fear and jealousy in the sense of another sort of religion being followed and this being left behind, which, right, is actualized in the third story. And you totally gagged me. Don Paolo definitely is the main character. I guess I just saw throughout the three stories the novices as who I was most interested in, like those who want to pioneer new things as opposed to ruminating on them. So like Brother Francis, Don Taddeo, and then Joshua, who goes to space. He's a part of the Leibowitzians? I think that's what they call themselves.
Something like that.
The novices in each respective story are what kept me going.
Totally.
Especially with the pilgrim, when he goes, it's not him. The pilgrim is in all three stories. And Steve, you want to explain who the pilgrim is?
Well, so we're not really sure. They call him simply the old Jew. But it's hinted at times that he's Lazarus, as in the guy who shortly before his own death, Jesus is said to have resurrected. You get this idea that he's been unflattered in the long run of history by that decision, the decision of his own resurrection, because he's lived now this forever long life and seen the destruction of man. And so now he's waiting around for this new savior. And I guess I have a question for the room. Do we think that Dom Zerchi becomes the new one?
No.
Well, doesn't – when the nuclear bomb goes off and then we see the woman who's got a second head growing out of her, Rachel.
At that point, Rachel had separated and had become
Rachel,
her own person.
Then she gives him – what's it called? She just sort of like absolves him, right?
And absolution.
Absolution. Oh. Yeah. Steve got us there. I could not get us there.
What would we do without him?
So true. Well, we wouldn't have read A Canticle for Leibowitz, that's for sure.
I tell you that much.
It's the sort of book where, like, you're going to be thinking about this for a while, whether you want to or not.
Sorry.
And also with Thon, I sort of saw him as, in some ways, like a Judas figure at times. But the most interesting part with the poet, I thought, in relation to Thon, was the removable conscious, which is what Don Paolo explains to him, where essentially this poet who's sort of a pseudo court jester who just picks on these intellectuals who come to visit. He's got a glass eye and he calls it his talisman. So this sort of mythical orb that he sort of leaves behind and Thon takes it. What is the removable conscious? I understand how it's explained in the novel, but in a realer sense, what sort of commentary on human beings do you think that is?
Well, it's conscience, right? It's removable conscience. He gives it to what's the name of the Caesar figure? He calls it the removable conscience, and he gives it, or it's stolen from him by Thon, who then gives it to Hannigan, right? His cousin and the Caesar figure of the second story, the first great ruler of this new human age. I think it's meant to symbolize the fact that you can conquer and not kill everybody who disagrees with you, so long as you feel like you're being watched and you feel as though your actions have consequences. He didn't give the glass eye to his cousin and say, you know, shove it into your eye socket, similar to what the poet had done to him. He presumably put it on Hannigan's desk and had it watch him. It's a symbolic gesture, presumably, that means your actions affect other people, and not just other people in some, you know, way they tell you in kindergarten, but will affect history.
Do you think that the idea of being watched ties back into even Brother Francis, and when he comes upon the sort of ancient hatch where he finds St. Leibowitz's documents and he turns Emily's skull around, St. Leibowitz's deceased wife?
That's I actually had not.
Great connection.
Yeah, I had not considered that.
I love the possession of objects. Francis doesn't even, it doesn't eat. You can't possess food in your body, and to possess this ancient artifact of St. Leibowitz is so important to Francis. And then we get the poet. I believe it's the poet who plays the game and wins the goat from the Lazarus character up on the hill. What do you think about possession? Because to me it was so pivotal to these characters, and like the more that you progress, it almost felt like the more that you're able to have these things that you get to keep in your body and your soul and your earthly possessions, and that just like increases throughout the story.
It's a question of human agency again. I mean, central core theme of the book, people realizing that their actions can have a wider effect, and people realizing that not only can the environment take from them, but potentially they can take back from the environment. That wager that you talked about between the hermit and the poet is the second time we see a game where somebody challenges someone at some sport skill over possession of an object, right? Previously, it was between the crook, the thief in the woods, and Brother Francis. And Brother Francis loses, and he loses not only some of his dignity, but loses the thing that he worked so hard on. And I mean, really, the robber took his win for granted even beforehand. He knew he was going to win. It was never a question.
I mean, Francis was like starving. He was emaciated.
Yeah, exactly. If you look at the challenge between the poet and the hermit, you don't know which of these guys is going to win, and they're fighting over these things that seem scarcely important to them, or are important to them only in bizarre, quasi-spiritual ways. This like strange mutated goat, for instance.
The author saying that it becomes a fairer playing ground over years, or does it just so happen to be those characters?
Less so a fairer playing ground, but more so a wider playing ground. Everyone, if they really want something, can take it from the next man, when previously the next man had nothing either, and you were just trying to get away from the wolves.
In these trivial disputes that you're talking about, at least in a grander scheme, it sort of feels like a simplified version of a grander issue, which is interesting in the idea of the simplification. I just wanted to point to you on 232. Thon sort of talks about, he says, simplification as a rebellion by a created servant species against the original creator species, as the fragmentary reference suggests. It would also explain why present-day humanity seems so inferior to the ancients, why our ancestors lapsed into barbarism when their masters were extinct.
Well, it's all a huge joke, right? I mean, he's reading from a theater piece, and he's wrong.
Yes. As Dom Paolo argues back, you know, why do you have to demean the past in order to create new ideas? But to deny that the past was archaic and did result in a simplified version of society, they killed all of the intellects, all of the artists. I mean, St. Leibowitz is a goddamn martyr for technological advancement. I don't think it's totally out of left field to make that argument, at least in this context. If someone made this argument right now about us, I would be like, screw you, you know, about like the men who went off to World War I and World War II. You know, we're still feeling those generational impacts. But I think that the idea that this novel isn't talking about, you know, isn't taking into consideration those generational ripples is a false one. And I found this, I found Don Paolo's argument to be contradictory.
To lean into the idea of generational trauma, it's Fantadio is almost illustrating that you can never understand the fullest extent of the impulses or choices or trauma of your ancestors, right? I mean, the people who fought in World War II, for instance, had a terrible, bloody existence for a number of years that I guess on paper would correspond to what their fathers had gone through in World War I, but it's not the same.
We have a whole population of those referred to as misborn, and it makes up such a huge part of their population that it, and especially in the third one where we have an Asian versus American dispute, that's the core problem which gets us into nuclear war, is also making commentary on the generational ripples that those nuclear bombs had on the Japanese. Like, to not be able to read into that, it's like, it sort of was very on the nose for me. Even Rachel as a symbol of that, the growing head out of that old lady whose name is just
escaping me.
We have this whole population which, at least in this context, seem to supersede our reality. Why even have that as a central part if we're so progressed, especially in the third one?
I think it's, for lack of a better word, excuse making. It's, well, we couldn't have done, I mean, it was an archaic version of ourselves that caused these cataclysmic events. It wasn't people as we are now, and now we have this opportunity to rebuild and do the same thing better, right? They go back and back and back to the theme of everyone is trying in their own right to remake Eden on Earth, and everybody thinks they can do it, and the closer they get, the harder they fall.
So is it the escape from blame, especially when we're literally getting on a rocket ship and leaving the planet at the very end?
It's hubris a little, and yeah, I agree with you. The escape literally from blame and
right.
The hope that you can get out of this cyclical destruction of yourselves.
I heard that there was a sequel. I'm curious to know if they make it to the other planet.
I was wondering, because I haven't really looked into it, do we know if it's a direct sequel, like it follows the novel?
It does. So the sequel was St. Leibowitz and the Wild Horsewoman, which was a direct following, and he wrote it over like 25 years because he was struggling with his own religious convictions and didn't feel super confident in releasing something. Also, his publishers didn't want to release it. I think it's interesting that it's the Wild Horsewoman, given how few and far between women are in this novel, Steve. Lady reporter. Lady reporter. Lady. Okay, just for reference, yesterday we were talking about this and I was like, Steve, there are no women in this book. And he was like, what? And I was like, lady reporter. And he was like, what? And then
I hadn't gotten there yet.
Yeah, and an hour later, I get a text. I just got to lady reporter. I was like, oh, your lucky day.
But we do get Rachel. So shout out, Rachel.
But the whole of the third story is these idiot men trying to figure out how to fit into a society that has now let women do things. Like, you have the one guy like stripping down to get in the bathtub, and then somebody walks in on him and he's humiliated because of course he is and he should be. Why was he stripping down in the middle of the monastery to get in the bathtub?
Okay, but why are women a part of that thematic construction and then have no weight in the narrative. You're just building a setting. You're not an actual actor or anything. And especially, like, there are certain lines in this book that are just straight up sexist. And you're writing this in the certain context of its time. But if you demean women trying to make commentary, you are still perpetuating that ideology. If you're saying, you know, this is woman's work and that that donkey isn't worth you, that's a woman's ass, like, it's still perpetrating those same notions. And it's hard when it's in a religious novel. At least it was for me.
And I would agree with you if I did get the sense that the author was laughing while typing this and being like, oh my God, they treat women so bad. But at no point do they even kind of really point that out.
But I mean, could you imagine if people had listened to Lady Reporter and had bothered to learn things about her? I mean, she's right the whole time. She's right that they're building secret nuclear missiles on a secret site on the moon and that they're planning to launch them at Asia.
Okay.
And nobody listened.
Right, but she's still a representative force of that social unrest, and she's on 4 pages.
Mm.
And this is a book that is, let's see,
long.
Pushing 338 pages?
Just a third, though.
Okay, but there are no women in the first two.
Set in the monastery.
Having them absent isn't a commentary. And when they are mentioned and it's in a demeaning way and it's always relative to men, you are situating women in a very boxed-in version of this society. And given that this was written in the 60s and this guy was losing it over all of the violence and horrible things that he had witnessed, especially, I think he served in World War II. So to then give us such a male-centered novel and have no nuance in the representative of women was disappointing. It was disappointing. And when I'm 200 pages in and I haven't heard one word from a lady, and the old lady that we hear from is unintelligible, I start to turn my nose up a little.
Feminist alert.
Feminist rant over.
So that makes me wonder what you guys would generally rate this book.
Well, in the words of the last title of the third book, Thy Will Be Done. Thy Will Be Done, and we are done with this book. Praise be. Sorry, Steve. It was just sort of hard to get through sometimes for me, just given how slow things worked sometimes. I don't know if you felt that way. This reminded me of Pale Fire, which Steve and I have very differing opinions on.
One of my favorite books. It's lovely.
Nabokov. For reference, author of Lolita.
Which I haven't read.
You haven't read Lolita?
Somehow, no.
Oh, wow. Well, you can. It's out there. But are there any books while we wrap up that, like, we could even sort of draw on? Not narratively, per se, but just sort of in format, in language?
I'm not sure. That's truthfully a tough one. It's one of the more unique stories I've read in a while. I would return to what I was saying more towards the beginning, where I think at least the first two stories very much resemble campus novels in construction. So if you're reading something like a Stoner or something like a Lucky Jim, if you're in the mood for something more funny, you'll see similar tropes and world construction.
The only thing that I can really compare it to that gets close is the idea of, like, this nuclear explosion fallout, what happens afterwards.
Oppenheimer?
Yeah, this is completely fair.
You know what it's really like? Fallout New Vegas, the fourth game in the Fallout series, just ripped off the entire socio-political construction from the second book of this novel.
That's the guy with the thumb, right? He goes, that's the video game, right?
Maybe.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
yes,
that guy.
That's Fallout.
Oh,
okay, the blonde one.
Yeah, yeah, but specifically the one set in this exact same area after a nuclear apocalypse.
Why aren't more people talking about this?
Because nobody's read these weird books from the 60s.
Well, if we wanted to expand that circle, who would you recommend this to?
People in grad school.
Yeah, if you're writing a dissertation. Yeah. What would you rate it?
Solid 8.
6.5.
Yeah, I would say probably 5.5. That's going to be my rating. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you so much for being on, Steve.
So for our CMU question of the week, we're going to ask, where's the best place to have a breakdown on campus?
Well, if you're me, it'll be somewhere super inconvenient, like right outside of Purnell. I cannot tell you the amount of times I'm walking on that Penguin Bridge, then I just stop in front of Purnell with no care in the world that movie stars-to-be see me just choking up. Anyway, so how about you, Steve?
Meanwhile, they're blowing cigarette smoke in your face.
Right in your face.
Being generally annoying. But for me, it's there's this bench at the top of, you know, Flagstaff Hill.
I'm familiar with said bench.
Yeah, that bench.
I'm going to say my favorite place to have a breakdown is the bench outside Baker, because I would have, as a freshman, I would have meetings with Jeffrey Hinkleman, and he would destroy my papers, and I would walk out and cry.
Jeff? No. No.
Remember to follow us on Instagram at @CMUBooked. Reach out if you want to be a guest.
Just like come and find me in my film equipment office. You can have a nice little seat on my lap.
And just... Thanks so much.
Thanks, Steve.
Happy to be here. Thank you guys for having me on. Thank you.